PTSD and your emotions. And I think you've given us a big charge, really, to have a lot of things in mind. We appreciate your time and your thinking and all of your omets. Is that the right word?
That's what you're trying to say. your
energy and desire to
sure.
what is a good word for all this?
Courage.
Courage and fortitude.
Fortitude. Well, anyway, we really appreciate it. If anybody wants to take a deep breath after that. We appreciate it very much. So, for our next comedy act, Rabbi Dr. Jeffrey Wolf and I were at Yeshiva University together in the early 1980s, where he became a devoted and cherished student of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. He serves as a senior lecturer in the Talmud department.
Professor.
What was that?
They bled me dry for that.
Associate professor. In the Talmud department at Bar Ilan. So far, so good. He specializes in the history of halakha, medieval and Renaissance Jewish history, and the interaction between Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. He is the author of The Fabric of Religious Life in Medieval Ashkenaz, perhaps more than that. He received his MA and PhD in medieval Jewish history and literature at Harvard University, and has served as a visiting professor at Yale University, Yeshiva University, and New York University. Jeffrey has a host of shiurim in English on his Facebook page, as well as yutorah.org. And if you enjoy a clear, researched, intellectual, and intelligent shiur with good cheer and a warm and engaging personality, our next speaker is well worth your investment. So, dear friends, please welcome Rabbi Dr. Jeffrey Wolf.
Thank you. Shana Tova. I have to tell you that both Batya and Caroline liberated me. I'm usually in lecture mode, and sometimes when I would visit the States and people ask how long do you want to talk, and I would say, well, the default in an academic setting is an hour and a half, and they would in horror look at me. Oh no. I found when Caroline and Batya said to be so personal and so revealing that I decided I'm going to use some of my notes, but actually speak more from the heart, which is my saying it. That is actually something of a surrender as well. Iman and I both from New England, and there was a time in my life when I said hot. Heart, but that's what happens. You end up sounding like you come from the Midwest after war. The topic was Rosh Hashanah Sha'avar Ad Rosh Hashanah Zeh. And the truth of the matter is that's only half of the sentence. In the 12th century, there was a major controversy. There was a major controversy between Rabbi Jacob Tam and everybody else in the world as to how do you say Kol Nidre. So the general practice was Mi Yom Kippurim Sha'avar Ad Yom Kippurim Zeh, from last Yom Kippur to this Yom Kippur. Rabbi Avner Tam said, no, we have to go from Yom Kippurim Zeh Ad Yom Kippurim Haba. What's the point of of concern? Part of it was a polemical thing. The Christians were accusing the Jews of total and absolute unreliability and dishonesty, as if by saying Kol Nidre we would abrogate all of our obligations to them because Jews are slippery. It was around that time of history that, in fact, the idea of Jew is satanic began to take hold. The first real blood libels dated from then, so it was a sort of a very dicey kind of time. Rabbi Tam himself was almost murdered by a crusader, and there was reason to rethink the formulation, but that wasn't the reason that Rabbi Tam said. We have to start from now and go forward. He said, if you don't take the lessons of what you learned and apply them and look forward to how you're going to implement them, then really the lessons of the past aren't worth anything. So that's why we have a sort of clumsy kol nidre the way we recite it, and we the chazan has to put an extra effort in to say both miyom kippurim sha'avar ad yom kippurim zeh, and miyom kippurim zeh ad yom kippurim haba. So in trying to think about what I what I personally feel like I've learned over the past year, truth is when I began to write down little notes, like things kept like pouring out, and it was just so much. Well, we had so much time alone, and so much time to think, and so much time to experience and feel, which is something which we don't often have sufficient time to do. We're running around like my mother had a wonderful expression, like fasamta moizen. I don't know what fasamta moizen is. Fasamta moizen is a poison mouse. And of course, running around like this and around, it doesn't have time to feel. So we have plenty of time to feel this year. So I, in no particular order, I'd like to talk about four things that I think I've learned, and they only touch the surface. Number one, I've learned to appreciate time. Now, when we live here, and those of us who've lived here through not such simple times, especially here in the Bronx, I know how fragile life can be. But there's a difference between the fragility of life and time. We say all kinds of horrible things about time. We say, well, I have to kill some time. Or I'm going to buy myself some time. And one of the things that is really very, I think we have to keep it in light of the fact that time doesn't belong to us. Time is a gift. And time should be maximized because it's a gift. It's interesting. The Middle Ages is one of the reasons why people thought that lending money at interest should be prohibited is because it's basically stealing, not the money. Because the person who charges for a loan is actually selling time, and time belongs to God. Time belongs to God. So the truth of the matter is, the first thing I think I learned was time, using time properly and not wasting. Now, I have a function at my age as well. But it's also true that every single minute is precious, and when you realize that there's a plague on the outside, and every single interaction you have with people you love is critical, then you have to realize that time is the most precious thing that we have ever been given. For me personally, this was brought home. Especially because I actually lost members of my family to Corona, cousin Milan and some others who were in the midst of their, at the height of their actually activity when they were cut down. One of the interesting things about time is we have a certain, one. I want to add one little note. Rav Soloveitchik, and I didn't have the privilege of becoming a student of Rav Soloveitchik in NYU. I actually started learning with him in Boston in 1973 because I was one of these extra privileges you have. The Rav points out that one of the things about tshuva is the fact that tshuva restores or changes our attitude towards time. When I was the commander of the rapid deployment force of the Bashans in Efrat here during the Oslo War, I don't like this, it's a father stuff. During the Oslo War, you learned all kinds of police jargon. So one part of police jargon is a person who commits a crime and gets a resh pay. What's a resh pay? A rishum plili. He gets a yellow sheet. Everybody watches the Fields Crime TV, I guess. One of the things that tshuva lets us do is to wipe away the resh pay. It means as if we undo the crime. But that's only because God lets us have access to our time database. Because ultimately, that's the first thing, and I'm sort of made a decision that made a determination, I don't know if I can keep it, to appreciate time. Time to be used constructively, time with family, time with loved ones. The second thing was, isolation did. I'm not going to talk about family. I agree with Caroline there. But there's something about isolation which works two ways. We were all cut into our houses, and yet we were hooked into the whole world. And that was both liberating and depressing and engaging and defiling. It was liberating in the sense that I never had to stop teaching. On the contrary, I ended up, from my little study, speaking all over the world. I, over the course of the past year and a half, without leaving, I haven't been out of the country in 2 years, which is very weird for me, I managed to be in Mexico City, Australia, Rome. Rome is actually cool because I was wearing sandals and shorts, but a jacket at the time. I spoke at the Vatican. Then I found out that I don't know if anybody knows this, but the guy who, I spoke for the Acton Institute because the head of research is a friend of mine. It turns out the Acton Institute was founded by the brother of the guy who plays Polly Walnuts on The Sopranos. I just found that out. So, but I found out that before he became a priest, he also was a tzatziki. But anyways, in any event, so that was very liberating. The opportunity to be able to really reach tons and tons and tons and tons of people was amazing. On Mondays, I ended up being asked by Rabbi Ariel Constantine of the Tel Aviv International Synagogue to give a half-hour shiur on Pirkei Avot, and which ended up becoming, I'll talk about all kinds of stuff. But what was striking is he has a worldwide audience, and I became aware, because a lot of the people that tune in are actually considering conversion. I became very much aware of the full dimension. I've written about this in all kinds of newspapers, but full dimensions of the conversion crisis and the need to make the Yur accessible to those who seek it, because the existence of a increasingly large non-halachically non-Jewish population in the state of Israel is a security is dangerous not only for our unity but also for our security, because the tribal unity and the tribal accessibility and the ability of everybody to marry everybody else is a major factor in Israeli solidarity. Historically speaking, the only thing which has ever led to fatal schism in the Jewish people has been that issue. That's how the early Christians ended up stopped being Jews. That's how the Karaites stopped. That's how Sabadians stopped. And God help me, that's how most of American Jewry. That's the way they go. So I became aware of it, and it got me to do something to put my money where my mouth comes. So I'm now a judge on a conversion court. So that actually was a life changer for me. So it was empowering and liberating and wonderful. It was also depressing. It's funny, Maimonides, I'm not going to read you the whole chapter, but the Maimonides in the book in the Laws of Moral Conduct talks about people being social animals, and they're influenced by their surroundings. So he says you should pick, when you go look for a house, you should look for the right, the right kind of environment, what kind of people, and so on and so forth. And then he talks about different possibilities of living. And only at the very, very end does he say, the world is really, really crazy and awful. You should, like, go out in the desert by yourself and do that. But that's only the last resort. Because people ultimately desperately, they can't live through screens. They can't live through televisions, and they can't live through, my granddaughter thinks that thought for a year that my wife lived in the telephone. That's not a way to live. And I think we realized the limits of our digital age in that regard. The isolation was wonderful. You get time for thought, for writing, for reading, and it was also defiling. Why was it defiling? Because I spend a lot of time on social media, A lot of it is doing pro-Israel hasbara. A lot of it is doing sane orthodoxy hasbara. So, you know, often a lot of people think that those two words don't go together. They do. I think they can anyway. And I discovered a lot of, I discovered first of all the danger of social media, because it puts all of us, people don't like conflict. And therefore we end up living in our own little echo chambers, and we don't encounter other people who are different than we are. That hurts us, that hurts them, and it prevents different parts of society from learning how to interact respectfully and to understand the language they're speaking. There is no question in my mind that the viciousness, I mean, Israeli policy is always vicious, but the viciousness and the insanity of the last two or three election cycles is firmly rooted in the fact that everybody did it from behind us. And people have a tendency to cook in their own juices, and that's not good for our own health, and it's not good for our society, because we all have to live here together. That was part of the, and it's, why is it defiling? It's defiling because when the person you are interacting with is behind a screen, either you can see them or not, but you're writing, you no longer see a person, you no longer see a person created in the image of God, you no longer see a element of Him, and you just let it go. And the kind of abuse, and the kind of, the people say to each other things on social media which they would never ever say to their face. That is a sin that we commit, and is committed on us, and that's defiling. Because sin of that sort is defiling. How many times have you thought, when you've interacted with people, and said, gee, I wish I could take a shower after that? That's the kind of price that Corona took, and which requires us to take a double dose of restraint to be able to not go down, I'm a Star Wars fan, not go down the path to the dark side. It did highlight, however, another thing is the fact that this sort of inability to interact is the fact that there are large sectors of our people with whom we don't speak the same language. And my daughter always likes to remind me that according to Chazal, only 20% of the Israelites left Egypt, and the rest died during the days of darkness. I suspect that the number that are dying in the days of darkness in the United States and in the diaspora is a much higher percentage. And that actually breaks my heart. But I think it's something we have to get used to. Now, I know one of the newest additions to Efrat, it's Speaker Klein, who has dedicated his life to repairing relations between our two communities. I'm far less, I'm brokenhearted, but far less optimistic. Number three, I think for me anyways, the world of Corona taught me humility. Things that I thought were important aren't really that important. The fact that a virus can lay low an entire planet taught me two things. It taught me first, as I said, priorities. And second of all, taught me that, made me very much aware of the fact that at the end of the day, we could rely on each other, but we have no one to rely on. It's really no one to rely on but God. Because if anything has taught us the limits of our abilities, and even with the vaccine, it's Corona. Finally, as we in the run up to this Rosh Hashanah, I think I'm trying to learn omitz, trying to learn courage. One of the things that the Kabbalists, it's actually Lubavitch, one of the things I started doing, I've been on an anti-Lubavitch rage for about 35 years. And my wife is from a Lubavitch family, which doesn't make for just a conversation. This year, actually, I started learning Tanya, which it was actually one of the nice parts of this. through social media, I had really the privilege of becoming good friends with Manny Steinsaltz, or Steinsaltz's son. And so through him, I started looking at his father's parish on the Tanya. And it's been an eye-opener. It even overlaps between that and what the end of Charles Soloveitchik thought. One of the things that Lubavitch emphasizes is the idea that from the beginning of Elul HaMelech Basadeh, God is accessible. And one of the things that Soloveitchik always thought was the fact that every single holiday, every single major holiday, certainly has a run-up, has a preparation time. And Elul is preparation for Shoshana, Rosh Hashanah is preparation for Yom Kippur. And things go on and become more and more intensive as time goes on, until we get to Yom Kippur. And in Yom Kippur, we basically immerse ourselves in sanctity. We immerse ourselves in God's presence. It's almost, in fact, it is compared to a mikvah. That's what the last Mishnah in Yonah teaches us, that it's a spiritual mikvah in which we are immersed. And then all of a sudden comes Sukkot, and we're out of the house. The function of the Sukkot is to teach us that we can actually create a context of sanctity, of subvert all that we learned from the 40 days running up to Yom Kippur and bring them outside. But then Sukkot is over, and Cheshvan is a blank slate. We're sort of kicked out. And I found that during, even when we were allowed out of the house, that I'd acquired agoraphobia. That it was scary to go out of the house. The outside is scary. After Yom Kippur is scary. Yom Kippur, you can't sit, right? What could you do, right? But afterwards, you've got to take the one step out of the house. I find it very scary. Okay? I still find it scary. I still think when they tell me the meeting will be on Zoom, I go, oh, good. But that's not the message. The message is, with the masks, and with the this, and with the that, to try to take the step outside the house, outside of our comfort zone, take all that we've learned, and implement it in the real world. So learn how to talk to each other, to interact with people with whom we disagree, to realize that we have more in common than we might think. That at the end of the day, apropos what Caroline said, we are better than our leaders. We are better than our government. We are better than our spiritual leaders. We are better with each. The Jewish people, we're better at hard times and good times. We're not going to celebrate, not just mourn, but that's the point. And we can do it. And that's why Rebbeinu Tam insisted that it's not only from last Yom Kippur to this Yom Kippur, from last Rosh Hashanah to this